danger is stealing in as relapse comes above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day when you give in. Give in. Give in. Give in.
Hello and welcome to episode 258 of the Thinking Poker Podcast. From Catonsville, Maryland, I'm Andrew Brokus, and I'm coming to you from Maryland for the last time, for at least a while. It's currently Sunday. I will be leaving for the World Series of Poker on Wednesday. Very much looking forward to that. Not exactly sure how that's going to end up affecting the podcast. I know it's already been a little bit more sporadic than usual, and of course, I'm about to get a lot busier, but we'll do what we can. We will do what we can to keep putting out new episodes. Nate was not able to join me for this episode. This was kind of a last minute thing that I did here, sitting down with Zach Elwood. Many of you probably know Zach from his books, Reading Poker Tales, Verbal Poker Tales, and Exploiting Poker Tales. Those are all books that I highly recommend. I'll have an affiliate link in the show notes for this episode. So if you do decide to purchase them, I would certainly appreciate if you used that link. That said, I hope it's clear we don't tout a whole lot of stuff on this show. And despite the fact that this is an affiliate link, the main reason that I'm promoting it is that, or I guess of all the things that I could get affiliate links for, let's put it that way, of all the things I could get affiliate links for, the reason you don't hear me promoting very many of them and you do hear me promoting this one is that I legitimately think these books are really good and it's material that I rely on pretty heavily for focusing on this part of poker, and I think Zach just does it better than anyone. Not that they're mutually exclusive with another book like Kara's Book of Poker Tales, which also has its applications. But yeah, big fan of Zach's work. What you may not know is that Zach was one of our very earliest guests on this show. He was on episode 14, which, as we'll discuss at the beginning of our interview, was over 5 years ago. All of Zach's books have been out for a few years as well, and Zach is actually not that immersed in the poker world anymore. So we talk a bit about poker, and then we kind of move on to a new, I don't know if passion's quite the right word, project of Zach's, which is investigating fake accounts on Facebook and other social media platforms. And in my view, I mean, I think there's kind of a parallel between being interested in deception in poker and deception on social media. I'm not sure if Zach quite sees it that way. We talk a little bit about that as well. But in any event, I think it's pretty interesting what he's doing and some of what he's finding. And so we talked some just kind of about the phenomenon of fake social media stuff. And I think Zach just has a perspective on this that's pretty different from, I mean, I know there's a lot of, kind of scuttlebutt that's been going on about, I mean, fake news has basically become a cliche at this point. And I think Zach understands this issue and has seen it up close in a way that a lot of other sources, that I at least have been, at least passively hearing about the fake accounts and that kind of thing. I think Zach has a much deeper understanding of the issue, and I appreciated that from talking to him. I hope some of you will find it interesting as well. We are going to come back around to poker towards the end of the interview. He and I do talk about a hand that I played where, actually, I wasn't involved in the hand, but I folded pre-flop. I was not one of the main contestants in the hand, but some behavior that I observed and a prediction that I was able to make about a player's hand based on the behavior that I observed. And we talked some about the importance of context for interpreting tells. And I think that turns into a pretty interesting discussion. So there is some poker stuff at the beginning and some poker strategy stuff towards the end. Last thing I want to let you know is for those of you who are going to be in Las Vegas, are planning a KnitCast meetup. It's a little trickier scheduling-wise this year. The plan is to do it on July 8th, which is a Sunday. So it would be Sunday, 10 a.m. to noon at the Gold Coast Bowling Alley on July 8th. The complication here is that this is day three or day four of the WSOP main event. If I am still in the tournament, I'm not going to want to spend a lot of time at the meetup that morning. I will, you know, at least stop in and say hi to everyone. And of course, there'll be other people there to hang out with. Just with the way the main event times out this year, you know, typically we've done it on a day one that corresponded with a weekend, and that's not possible this year. So this seemed like the best option. Certainly, you know, if you do see me wandering around the Rio, feel free to say hi. The World Series of Poker can be frustrating, and hearing from fans of the show can be a nice pick-me-up, spirit-wise. I appreciate, you know, I've gotten some offers already of people saying, you know, it'd be nice, let's get a beer, I'll buy you dinner, etc. I appreciate all those kinds of offers. It's not entirely off the table, but it's a very busy time of year for me, and I'm not the most social person in the first place. Like, essentially, meeting new people for me is a little taxing or draining in a way that I think that's a sustained, like, sort of like shaking your hand in the hallway is perfectly welcome. Meeting new people in the sense of, like, you know, sitting down for an hour or two is draining for me in a way that poker is also draining for me, and it's not necessarily something that I'm looking to combine with the World Series of Poker. So if I decline an offer like that, it's not personal. It's just probably not something I'm going to prioritize during the World Series of Poker, but I am very flattered and appreciative that it's something that folks are interested in, and I do look forward to meeting a lot of you this summer. Now, let's go talk Zachary Elwood.
Yeah,
I thought that was more recent. Wow.
Yeah, you were our episode 14, one of our very earliest guests.
Oh, I'm honored. it's crazy how old I realized I am.
Yeah.
The other night I was sitting around thinking, like, oh my god, I'm 40 years old, and it just kind of struck me. I guess that's how people have midlife crises, where they're like, oh my god.
I didn't realize you were quite that old. I think, yeah. I had that same when we met in person. I thought, I was assuming you were younger than I am, and you've actually got a few years on me.
Yeah, how old are you?
I'm about to turn 36.
It was coming to me because I was like, I'm 40, and then it really struck me when I thought about my sister, because my sister is 2 years younger than me, but I never had thought of her as being 38. I was like, my sister's 38, my god.
Yeah, my little brother just got married a couple months ago. That's a bit of a wake-up call.
Yeah, so time really flies. That's no joke.
Well, so, I mean, broadly, what have you been up to since the... I know you've published a couple books since the last time we spoke, right? So when we spoke in January of 2013, you had just pretty recently published Reading Poker Tales. So since then, you've published Verbal Poker Tales and Exploiting Poker Tales, which I just finished rereading for my third read-through, my second reread, in preparation for the World Series of Poker. I really love those books, and I recommend them to a lot of people. Do you want to give us a quick elevator pitch on, you know, distinguishing those two books from Reading Poker Tales?
Oh, sure, yeah, and thanks. And thanks for, I'm glad you liked them, because that means a lot, definitely. You know, when experienced players say they like them, that's awesome.
Well, it helps that I'm quoted in Exploding Poker Tales, so you found the right way to my heart.
Right, flattery helps a lot, I guess. What was I going to say? Oh, yeah, differentiating. So basically, like, Exploding Poker Tales, well, Verbal Poker Tales was obviously just about verbal stuff, and I had a lot more to say on that than I thought at first, because I thought it would be, I started out thinking it would be a rather short book, and then the more I delved into it, I found more to say and used a lot of, like, real televised hand examples. And then for Exploding Poker Tales, that was more of a way to come back to more of the physical stuff, because I thought my thinking on that stuff had improved since I put out Reading Poker Tales. So I wanted to, you know, get back to talking about physical stuff, and also, like, use a lot of real world examples, because Reading Poker Tales was really light on, like, real world kind of concrete examples of this kind of stuff. And so I wanted to use examples from my own life, and also from other people, people's stories, and from televised hands and stuff that people might know. So yeah, that was my attempt to get back to focusing on the physical, the nonverbal stuff. Yeah.
How well did you feel like you did with that? I mean, do you feel like you've sort of accomplished what you wanted to accomplish with your investigation of tells in poker?
Yeah, I think so. Like, I don't have too much more I think I can say. Like, that's why I said that last one was the third one was my last book, just because I don't think I'd ever have enough to, like, create a new book on. I feel like I would more rather just make updates to the existing books or else make a video or an article or something. Like, I feel like I'm pretty proud of those books. I'd say, like, you know, reading Poker Pills, you know, I see some things I don't like about it, but I still decided to keep it as it was because so many people enjoyed, like, the conceptual framework of it, so I kept it as it was. And, but yeah, I'm really proud of all three of them, and I don't foresee myself ever making a new book anyway.
It still seems like you're keeping up a little bit. I mean, I know you said you haven't been around the poker world as much, but it seems like you're still watching televised poker stuff now and again, and you're tweeting about tells that you see and stuff like that.
Yeah, I still, especially now because I'm working on some videos for the video series, so I like to, you know, because for the membership, it's a lifetime membership, so I do like to add occasionally videos to it. So, I will, even though I haven't played much poker recently or even watched that much, I still want to add, like, because I have all these notes from previously that I made about ideas for videos, so I occasionally try to work on them and get some out.
Do you still do the consulting with players?
Yeah, I mean, if people, I have done recently some private things a couple times in the last couple years where, aside from the WSOP stuff I did, the last one was in 2015 for that, but I did some private, like, video analysis for a couple players who were playing on some high stakes televised games with players who had had a good amount of footage to study, and I would study their tells and also, like, their opponent's tells and stuff. So I did a little bit of private analysis, not much, just a couple times.
Yeah, that's pretty neat, though. And I mean, you kind of obliquely referenced this, but I mean, you were doing some consulting with players who were playing at the final table of the main event. Was it just the one person who hired you to do that?
It was two. It was Amir Lahavit in 2013 and then Max Steinberg in 2015.
How did you like that experience? It sounds like that would be a lot of fun.
Oh yeah, it was a lot of fun. I mean, we all went into it, you know, knowing that it was pretty unlikely that we would find, like, something game-changing, you know, with the level of play and in players and just how much time people have to prepare for that, which they don't have anymore, you know, because they've made it more, you know, they got rid of the November 9 gap.
Right.
So I think, yeah, I really enjoyed it. It was, like, you know, a chance to really, like, study, you know, experienced players and look for really subtle things that might just, you know, give you a small edge. But yeah, we all went into it thinking there wasn't much chance of finding something game-changing. And while, you know, while I found some things that I thought were, like, slightly reliable, yeah, we didn't find, you know, there wasn't, like, a, you know, aha, there was a huge tell kind of moment. It was more like, this might come in handy in some specific situation, theoretically, if you were on the fence.
Yeah, but I mean, the stakes are so high at that point. It's sort of like even a 1% chance of using something that's going to give you a 5% edge in that actual hand, you know, could still justify paying thousands of dollars to get that information.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, like I definitely, like, if it was me, I would definitely want to cover my base and be like, you know, if there is something interesting to find, like, I want to make sure I find it. Because, like, you know, my favorite example of that is from the 2011 WSOP main event where I found what I thought were some pretty valuable tells on P.S. Hines, and because he was pretty new to live play. And, you know, just the chance of finding something that you think is pretty valuable is, you know, paying to cover that base, I think, is valuable when so much money is at stake, you know.
What's your process when you're doing something like that? I mean, I guess, first off, how do you go about gathering the footage that you're going to look through? I mean, that's all just publicly available on YouTube or whatever?
Right. I mean, like, for example, like, for when it's studying other people's, you know, opponents' footage, you'll try to find anything you can, any footage that exists, which, you know, for example, in the 2013 main event, there was, you know, previous footage from other events for some other players, like Ryan Reese. You could find in an online, like, 6-hour tournament final table from, like, you know, I can't remember what casino, but they had put a stream of it up online. You could watch, you know, a tournament that he played like a year ago or something like that. So it's just finding finding all the footage available, and then, like, you know, I have kind of a system where, like, I have a spreadsheet, and then, like, use tags for different situations, and then at the end of, like, transcribing all the footage, you go back and look at similar situations, you know, compare them to each other.
How common would you find it to be that someone, like you mentioned Ryan Reese having been at this final table a year ago, that, I mean, would you typically expect that he would still have the same behavior patterns, or do you have a sense of how often people are becoming aware of and changing these things, or I guess even changing them without becoming aware of them?
Oh yeah, it would be pretty unlikely. Like, you have to go into it with a pretty skeptical mindset, especially considering there was, you know, several months gap before November 9. Like, everybody's going to be, like, thinking about that kind of stuff and trying to rid themselves of anything and be super stoic at the final table, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's pretty rare in like a high stakes televised game that you'll find, like, tells that you're, like, confident of. I mean, it's pretty rare. Like, it's only happened, you know, when you talk about, like, the main event final table, it's a handful of times where I was like, oh, I'm, like, dead certain that's some, right. such, you know. But just the, you kind of, like, just have to cover your bases and, like, see what's out there and see, you know, maybe there's something, you know, sometimes people just have blind spots, like the thing I found with P.S. Hines, where he would look down when he didn't have, when he had a hand, and he would look at his opponent and stare at him when he didn't have a hand. You know, it was, like, a pretty reliable dichotomy there. And so you just have to, like, cover your base and look for those things, even if you think it's very unlikely you'll find them.
Do you play much poker anymore?
No, I'm pretty out of the game. Like, I played a few months ago, and they have this, I'll give a little plug for it. They have a 5-5 and a 5-10 game sometimes in Portland where they televise. It's like once a week they do like a recorded game where you get the hole cards and everything. It's at Portland Meadows, which is a racetrack, and they put a poker room into it pretty recently. So that was the last time I played, I think, like several months ago on that. But yeah, I'm pretty out of the scene. Like, I've been doing some tech writing for software, and I've been doing, you know, the occasional poker stuff, and then doing some stuff with fake accounts and online research kind of stuff.
Yeah, what's I mean, I guess maybe just start with an overview of what that is.
Oh, the fake account stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, this was just something I kind of got randomly into because after Trump got elected, I was curious what was going on in these Facebook groups, so I joined a bunch of pro-Trump Facebook groups, and I just started seeing all this, you know, fake foreign, obviously foreign posts coming, you know, of like the fake news, Macedonian origin fake news sites, and obvious foreign people posting, you know, pro-Trump content. And I was like, what is this? Like, I hadn't seen any news about it. So I was like, why aren't people talking about this more? So I just started keeping a spreadsheet of all these things, and especially like the weird, like, American impersonating ones, which were like, you know, had American profile details and pictures, but like were obviously not, they were just deceptive. So I just started keeping a spreadsheet of those things, and then that kind of led to me sharing that with some reporters who used it in their articles later.
So this was something where you were already aware that this phenomenon was happening and you went to investigate it, or you were just sort of like, I wonder what's going on in these pro-Trump Facebook groups, and joined them, and then were like, oh, holy crap, there's a lot of fake accounts in here.
Yeah, I didn't really know much about it when I joined those groups. It was more like, I like to just see, you know, what people are doing, and like, I like to hear all sides of stuff and see, you know, what all sides of an issue are talking about. That was kind of my interest. And then I just noticed being in those groups, like how much fake content there was. It was literally like, even today, you can, in some of these groups, it's like the majority, you know, shockingly, it's like, can be the majority of content posted is from these deceptive fake accounts. So it's just kind of mind-blowing that all these things are just riling up Americans, you know, a certain section of Americans, and getting them angry about stuff that's not real or like super biased framing of it, you know. So yeah, it was just kind of crazy to me, and the fact that all the Russian stuff got so much attention, whereas this stuff wasn't clearly Russian. It was just like either like monetarily driven, or, you know, Eastern Europe, you know, country origins. And just everybody was focused on like the clearly Russian proven stuff because that seemed to get more, you know, clicks, I guess. But it was kind of surprising to me that I hadn't seen it talked much about, which is why I was interested in it.
What you're suggesting, if I'm understanding you correctly, then, is that this isn't necessarily like a politically motivated, you know, conspiracy to influence the U.S. election or something like that, as much as kind of like clickbait, or like more on the order of clickbait.
Yeah, I think it's kind of a gray area, because it's definitely like, I mean, some people do believe that even though some of it is clearly financially motivated, like you can find articles about Macedonian teenagers making a lot of money, and you know, I know people who have interviewed those kids, you know, or those young people themselves who have made a lot of money doing this kind of stuff. But some of it's not that clear. Like, there's a gray area where it's like, well, how did this stuff start? Like, is it possible that, you know, Russia or whoever, somebody propaganda minded set the wheels in motion to produce this content and make it, you know, make it self-sustaining kind of thing, you know, where it became an industry, but who put the wheels in motion for that to be an industry, you know? And there's a lot of unknowns still, like, and you can also find stuff where it's like clearly propaganda and not click related, because, you know, if something doesn't have a link to it, like, it's like, why are they posting? You know, it's like, if it's just like clear, you know, some of it's just like posts where it's like, yeah, that there's no immediate gain they're getting out of that. And it's not like there's even a long-term gain, because usually their accounts get shut down after not too long either. You know, it's like, so it's not like there's some like long game they're playing. It's like, well, why are they posting just posts that don't have click, you know, links related to it? So there's a lot of weird stuff going on.
What's the monetization strategy? I mean, it's just like, click here for a video of Hillary Clinton eating a baby, and then when you click, it's links to like penis enlargement pills, or what's the?
Well, it's a common strategy of using these ad networks, which are, you know, like Google Ads is one ad network, but there's many other ad networks that automatically that you can sign up, like, say you set up a fake news site or whatever site, and you can, you know, use the ad network. And whenever people come to your site, you will get paid for views on that site, because you're part of that ad network, and it'll automatically play, you know, auto place these ads on your site, you know. And that's where you see these sites that are just like chock full of ads when you go to them. You'll go to these fake news sites, and it'll just be like half the page is these, you know, links to, you know, people trying to sell stuff, like shady products and stuff. So that's kind of the gist behind that, and you can find articles, like if you search for like Macedonian fake news, you can find several articles about all these people and how much money they make. Like, you know, there's stories of them making like tens of thousands of dollars a month on, you know, when at the peak of things, and then you know, most people make a lot less, but there is it's a pretty thriving industry. And there's even a guy, like, I found this Macedonian marketer guy who was like on his website. He has his own website, and it's like on the main page of his website, it's like he bills himself as the guy who helped Trump get elected, you know.
Yeah, I've seen you talk about him.
It's like just a crazy scene.
I wonder about some of that stuff, like with Cambridge Analytica too, especially some of the stuff. I mean, I feel like recently maybe it's been bad publicity for them, but I mean, I remember seeing some articles about them, you know, even before they really kind of blew up in the last couple of months, that to some degree, like, it's in their interest to exaggerate the extent to which, like, if they're trying to mm-hmm. get more business in the future, like, yeah, of course, right. They're going to claim that they were, like, the key thing right. that caused, which, you know, makes for very alarmist headlines to be like, oh, the only right. reason Trump won is because, you know, like, the Facebook exactly. sold your data, and that, and, like, if all the quotes for that right. are essentially from, like, a Cambridge Analytica employee talking about what a good product Cambridge Analytica is, that's a little questionable.
Yeah, it's very simplistic. Yeah, it's very simplistic. It's kind of like the Macedonian. Obviously, he has a motivation to say he had a large influence, even
right,
though, you
that's
know,
what made me
did,
think
he,
of
did he really? Yeah, exactly. It's like, and it's very simplistic, like, and a lot of, you know, anti-Trump people are like, you know, I don't fall into that group of saying, like, it's clearly, you know, this foreign influence that led people to vote, because I still feel like, I mean, I definitely think it had, like, a small impact. It's really hard to say how much, but, like, what that impact was, and, you know, if he still would have been elected without that, like, that's really hard to say. Yeah,
it seems to me there's a pretty clear through line from your interest in particular in the deception element of poker, because even as a poker player, you know, it seemed like the being interested in like tells and that sort of thing, and then to the deception online now. I mean, do you think I'm making too much of that, or do you see that connection?
Yeah, a little bit. I kind of wondered about that too, because it's kind of like, I kind of see it, but at the same time, I'm more just like, I kind of wondered if it was more like about the seeing that there was a this area that was relatively unfocused on, and like, why weren't people talking about it more? I think that that might be more of the connection, where I'm just like, when I see something where I'm like, I think people should be looking at it more, that kind of interests me. And I do like the tells aspect of it, because it's kind of like, you can look at some of these accounts and you can kind of get a, you can kind of read a few signs immediately that they're fake, and then it's kind of like you dig into them more and, you know, your read might be confirmed, or you might be in that gray area. Like, is this a fake account? Like, I'm not really sure, but I'm like 60% sure it's fake, you know?
What are the tells? What would cause something to jump out at you as a fake account?
Oh, well, you know, like, Twitter's an interesting space too, because Twitter's much harder to read, because, you know, it doesn't really punish anonymity or, you know, deception like Facebook says, you know, at least claims it does. So Twitter is interesting because it's like, you know, there's some interesting cases where it's like an account will have these details that are like, obviously, like kind of like bragging, like talking in their bio about things they've done, or like say they're an entrepreneur or a PhD or something, but then like not give any information about their full name or how to contact them. Like that's kind of like, you know, that's kind of a that doesn't make much sense. There's a, so that's kind of like I see some of those accounts where I'm like, this person says they were a, you know, a conflict specialist in the Middle East, but they don't have their information on how to contact them or their last name or something. It's kind of like, there's some signs there. And then, you know, when people are like are really super combative online, like, you know, insulting people, but they claim to have a, you know, a PhD or something. Right. That doesn't really add up either. A lot of these things are suspicious. Like, and I see that on all sides. Like, there's a lot of anti-Trump, like, resistance accounts that look super suspicious to me, that just, like, you know, and this is a known phenomenon, too, that, you know, people have talked about this, where they're just, like, steadily, you know, Twitter feeds are just constantly retweeting other people and, you know, insulting, you know, pro-Trump people, and it's kind of like, are these, like, foreign agents just riling up people or what, you know?
Do you have a thesis on that? I mean, motivation for something like that would be?
I mean, like, you know, they have talked about, you know, the proof where Russia was, like, you know, feeding both sides of issues, you know, just trying to increase division, which fits into their, you know, they've been doing stuff like this for a long time. Like, I'm reading this really interesting book right now called Disinformation, which is written by a guy who defected from the, you know, Russian propaganda machine, like, in the 80s or earlier, maybe. And he talks about, like, all the disinformation and propaganda campaigns that Russia did, like, after World War II, which is really eye-opening. You're kind of like, wow, how much of this, like, anti-American, anti-capitalist stuff originated with Russia, and we still have it around today, you know? Mm-hmm. It was really eye-opening, because I'd heard a bit about it, but to, like, hear specifics about the things that they did and how, you know, pretty despicable a lot of the stuff is, obviously. It's a good book.
How accurate, I guess the first question, you know, have you seen like the latest season of Homeland?
No, I haven't watched that.
So I mean, that show in general is not necessarily on topic with this, but the latest season, or maybe season and a half or something like that, that's a very central plot line, is the idea of Russia trying to create disunity in the United States with using social media. Like, that's I've thought of you many times in why it's also the weakest season of the show, so I'm not necessarily recommending it, but I was curious. I think that's probably one of the most prominent, you know, pop culture depictions of this.
Interesting. I'd like to check that out just for that reason. Yeah.
Yeah, that's why, even if you just like skipped straight to this newest season, like, plot wise certain things might not make sense to you, but yeah, the fake accounts.
Read Wikipedia.
Yeah. Or even I think the season before the current one, I think maybe the current one is 7 and the season before 6, there's a whole farm or whatever you would call it, you know, of people who are creating fake Facebook accounts, and you know, they actually go at some point to the place where this is happening, and so that shows up. But
check that out.
The other one, The Americans, is that a show you're familiar with?
Oh yeah, I've never seen it, but yeah, I read some spoiler alerts about the plot and everything, and looks pretty interesting. Yeah,
yeah, I was just curious about how good of a job you thought they were doing of kind of depicting the problem, but maybe I guess you're just not familiar with them.
Yeah, no, I'm not. Yeah, I mean, and the other thing is, like, I don't, you know, I'm obviously not an expert on this stuff. It's more like, that was one of the things I thought was interesting, too, when I talked to the New York Times reporter and the Washington Post reporter about it, was, you know, I'm just a regular guy. Like, it's not like I have any special knowledge about this stuff, but and that kind of, like, shows you how big of a problem it is for Facebook, like, you know, the fact that anybody can sit down and find these accounts and, like, say, like, here's a whole network of fake accounts, and, like, Facebook seems like unable or unwilling to do the, you know, the maximum they can to, like, shut this stuff down is kind of interesting, you know.
How shuttable down do you think it is? I mean, do you think there really is, like, low-hanging fruit that they're just not taking?
Yeah, I definitely think there is. I mean, like, the low-hanging fruit is like, when you have accounts that are using, like, literally the same pictures and the same names as other people, like, that should, I wouldn't think that would be a high bar for, like, you know, reaching an algorithmic solution to that. It's kind of like, why, there's definitely some low-hanging fruit there. Like, in that, the information I gave to the Washington Post recently for that recent article they had was, like, literally, like, and I'm not the first person to notice this. This was a known issue. But they would have, you know, you can find, like, dozens of the same account using the same photos, you know, with the same name. Like, they would copy. For some reason, for whatever reason, these fake account generators get in some kind of habit, or the fake account creators, you know, they might be completely different people. Like, there's multiple fake account creators, like, across the globe, and for some reason they choose to, like, copy the same person and use the same pictures. So you can find, like, dozens of the same person online. It's just really weird. Like, it doesn't make sense, even from, like, any sort of strategy sense. Like, why are they doing this? Because you would think that would be, like, the easiest stuff to shut down, and it is easy to shut down, but, like, they keep making more of them. Like, so, you know, the example was this guy named Steve Kaufman, who was a military guy who had gotten some, you know, featured in some article one time, and then for whatever reason that brought him to the attention of all these fake account creators, and, like, he had, like, there would just be dozens of his name and pics, and then, like, he would get them shut down, and then they would be more later, and they were just ongoing being created, and people would use them for various scams. You know, it wasn't just, like, political stuff, it was just, like, financial scams and dating scams and stuff. Is just, and that happens a lot. It's just really weird that you would think that would be a low-hanging fruit. Like, it's not like that you would think that would be a complex algorithm to solve.
Yeah. It seems like in addition to the fake account stuff, you just spend some time in some weird corners of the internet. I don't know how better to describe it than that. Just some of the stuff that you post on Twitter, I'm just like, what the hell is going on here? Like, what's...
Yeah, I think it's I think some of that started with this white nationalist Trump supporter who is a, you know, kind of a friend of the, I wouldn't call him a friend, but a acquaintance of the family, I'll call him.
Oh, and, like, of your family.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, and like, so I was on his email list, and I was kind of, like, struggling to understand his thought process and the stuff he was sharing with his email list. I'm like, I kind of want to understand this stuff, so, like, it led to me, like, learning about all this shit I had no interest in learning, but I just was kind of interested in knowing what made these people's mind work, tick, or whatever. And so, yeah, it led to me, like, knowing about some weird corners and philosophies of the internet, which are completely incoherent, but kind of fascinating for that reason.
Yeah, I mean, I've kind of... So there's been, like, this narrative, I guess, it's the election of, you know, people living in a bubble, people not live understanding people on the other side of them politically or something like that. And I think, well, I mean, it sounds like that was, to some degree, what motivated you to check out the Facebook groups in the first place, was feeling like you just kind of didn't understand where other people were coming from. Is that...
Yeah, for sure. Like, I'm not, you know, I do think there's a lot of, you know, the bubble so-called stuff. I think, well, also mainly I think that it's to our benefit to try to understand and talk to other people, even though it can be easy to, like, try to write them off and be like, these people are stupid, which in some cases they are, but it's like, at the same time, you know, I think the optimal solution is to try to engage them and not insult them, and try to understand their point of view and try to show them that, you know, maybe you can reach common ground and still, you know, and still criticize them, but not, like, you know, call them stupid. Criticize the ideas that they're supporting and not call the people stupid. You know, I think that's the optimal solution.
Yeah, and I think that that's kind of part of what I wanted to drive at, because I think sometimes that argument about the bubble or the dangers of the bubble or something like that is driven by a marketplace of ideas sort of argument of like, oh, you know, if you were exposed to these ideas, maybe you would better understand, like, one would have to presume some legitimacy to their ideas to make them worth looking into. Like, I think that's kind of the one of the stock mm-hmm. refutations of that, or of like why we don't need to listen to people from the other side, is sort of like, well, they're just objectionable people with objectionable ideas and we have nothing to learn from them.
Right,
and
right.
It sounds like what you're saying, which I think is pretty compelling, is that it's not only about sort of like learning from them to change your own opinion or something like that, but even just sociologically, I mean, and I'm not basing this only on stuff I've gotten from you, but it seems like there's some interesting and or potentially like troubling things that are happening in various corners of the internet, that there's a lot of reasons why it would behoove us, whatever that means, whatever group of people, to like be a little more aware of what the hell is going on.
Yeah, I think I guess my main philosophy is like, you know, I mean, it's kind of like I can see why it's so frustrating, because Trump is so clearly, you know, for people paying attention, like he's so clearly incoherent and irrational. So there can be a tendency to like treat his supporters and treat them badly, you know. But I think that's just like, it's not helpful. You know, it's kind of like, you know, I think the optimal, you know, the GTO strategy is like insult Trump or his or the things being enacted all you want, but like for the sake of like bringing people, finding common ground and bringing them, you know, to your side, the optimal solution is to, you know, treat people with respect and also like take their ideas seriously, because even though you may find them completely incoherent or dumb, it's kind of like engage them in that conversation and you know, and try to be the bigger person, because, you know, especially in social media, it's like things often reach a crescendo immediately where people are calling people idiots, and it's crazy how that's just like, you know, I'm on these horrible threads where I'm just like, it's just people calling people stupid all day. I'm just like, what? You know, like, social media is such a dumpster fire, you know? And I just feel like, you know, it's so easy to do, because you see there's so many things to make people upset these days, you know. And I don't know, I just feel like, yeah, we all have to like try to be, you know, bigger people and try to, you know, find common ground and have a real conversation and be respectful. Because I mean, like, I've had many encounters where I like it started out like in a very very angry way online, and then like, you know, by being respectful, they were like, oh yeah, I can see your point. And then like, I have a, you know, I started getting a lot of Trump supporters following me, because a few followed me, and then they must see that when they encounter me online, they see that these other Trump supporters follow me. So then I just started getting followed by all these Trump supporters, and they, you know, and I, you know, they probably unfollow me when I tweet something, you know, about Trump. But I guess my point is like, I think treating people with respect is just the best, you know, best option.
Yeah,
until they give you a reason to like not treat them with respect, you know.
Even aside from treating them with respect, it just seems like some of the just the idea of being in like a white nationalist Facebook group or something, I feel like it would be psychologically distressing.
Yeah, no, for sure. Yeah, and when I'm talking about like, I'm not necessarily talking about treating a white nationalist with respect, because I feel like
they're, I don't even mean treating them with, I just mean, yeah, like, yeah, literally to like be there and witness it, which I know, yeah, you know, yeah, there are other, yeah, and for at least for something as prominent as white nationalism, like there are some people who have kind of recognized the danger of people organizing online for a while and have you know, join those groups for the purposes of keeping an eye on them. You know, I've heard interviews with those kinds of people, and I guess I sort of respect what they're doing, but I really couldn't imagine myself. Like, I think it would just be too kind of upsetting.
Oh yeah, it's horrible. Yeah, it's horrible. I think one thing, like when I was interacting with this white nationalist acquaintance, because I did want to understand his points of view, even though like I'm like, I can't foresee ever, you know, taking his point of view seriously, because it makes no sense. But I did want to, like, for the sake of like questioning him and sending him like, look, what, this makes no logical sense. Like, why do you believe this? And here's the reasons why I'm criticizing your thought process. And I think that kind of thing is more helpful than saying, like, just writing off these people and saying they're unreachable, because that kind of, you know, to a certain extent, like, encourages them that they're cut off from some sort of, you know, mainstream. And, like, you know, by, I think you're more likely to, like, convert them to thinking more rational thoughts by engaging with them than you are to be like, well, we're not even going to have this conversation, you know?
Have you done, I mean, do you have success stories, I guess? Are there cases where you would say, like, okay, that felt like a good use of my time? I had a conversation with this person, and I'm happy with the outcome of it.
Well, the only time I'd say that, I mean, that really hasn't happened very often, except, like, I have, you know, there's been some stuff on Twitter where, like, we were like, you know, we found common ground, and they were like, yeah, it's, you know, people shouldn't be insulting people on both sides, you know? Like, people need to not, you know, be more respectful on all sides. And I was like, you realize, like, you know, because you'll get in these kind of, like, bubble, you know, Trump supporter groups were like, the liberals just attack us all day long, and they say very mean things to us. And I'm like, you realize that, you know, that you can just as easily find the opposite, you know, situation if I, you know, I could show that to you. They're like, oh, yeah, you're right. Yeah, you're right. It happens on both sides. And, you know, it's kind of like those conversations. And but I think the most worthwhile thing I've done, like, because a lot of this stuff hasn't been worthwhile, probably. But I'd say the most worthwhile thing I've done was probably going into these Trump groups where people are getting riled up constantly by these fake, biased, you know, weirdly framed news stories. And I'll go in there and be like, the person posting this account is a, you know, a fake American impersonating account, probably a Macedonian. And then I'll link to some screenshot from their account that shows something, you know, suspicious, like them, and, you know, it could be literally them in Macedonia, like a picture, or it could be like, you know, their URL that shows like a foreign, you know, name that's different from their profile name. So I'm like, and that has actually gotten pretty good traction, because people are like, oh, thanks for sharing. Yeah, this site is filled with fake news, you know, like, so trying to educate them, like, you know, this account is trying to drive you to a site that makes money off clicks, and it's and this person is impersonating American, because I think it kind of speaks to their language, where they kind of hate people that would impersonate Americans.
Right.
So
yeah, the like jingoism.
Right. It's kind of like, so use that in your favor, or, you know, for the greater good, and be like, and then I think that of all the things I've done is, like, I've encouraged people to do that, like, if they were looking for something to do, because I've had people, you know, respond like, oh, thanks, you know, wow, it's crazy that this is happening, you know, and then I'll share a link to an article about all the fake accounts, and they're like, oh, wow, that's crazy, you know. So if people are looking for something to do that I think is helpful, like, even if it's just one person at a time you're reaching, I mean, I think that's, you know, that's valuable, because it's making people more skeptical, which I think is the main thing, like, it's the main goal it should be for a lot of this fake, you know, online news, is like, we all need to be more skeptical, like, you know, and that includes the people that are skeptical of mainstream news, because they also need to be skeptical of the other random news that they're consuming, you know?
Yeah, and I guess of the sort of immediate, like, just, the idea that, like, it's necessarily fake because it was in New York Times or whatever, like, that is itself a claim that probably ought to be subject to skepticism.
Right. Yeah. Why do you believe that? Because you read it in some other, you know, random source, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I'm so part of me is kind of inclined to think, well, okay, media literacy is sort of the solution. Like, essentially, there's a story that I tell myself sometimes, is essentially that the, you know, we as human beings, we have strategies for determining credibility or something like that. And then there's always bad actors who are essentially trying to figure out what those strategies are and shortcut them. And so and there's a constant battle of kind of trying to keep up with that. And certain people are kind of less media savvy or savvy in general. And so more likely to, fall for those kinds of tricks. And so part of me thinks, okay, well, then the solution is something to do with a kind of media literacy or teaching better critical thinking or something like that. Mm-hmm. But then, I mean, part of me also thinks, well, but a lot of those people, I mean, a lot of the issue also is sort of a generational thing, I would think, like that there's a lot of older people on the internet for whom it's a technology that's less familiar to them. Mm-hmm. I mean, do you think that, first off, do you think that's just a wrong stereotype that, like, a lot of the people falling for this are older people?
No, I think that's, I mean, I think that's true. I mean, I just think of, like, you know, my wife's grandmother, like, you know, she was reading, you know, the National Enquirer and thinking that was real news, you know. They kind of, like, lose their, you know, it can be easy to lose their sense of, like, where the real news is, where the fake news is, you know. I mean, the older you get to, but yeah, it's also, yeah, generational, like you say, like, they're not used to being skeptical like younger people are now, who see so much, you know. They've been brought up in that environment, so they kind of see the bullshit that goes on, whereas older people just might not be in that mindset, you know, because they're used to just getting the news, you know. Yeah,
although, I mean, I guess I would say it would have been good if people had been, you know, more skeptical of, you know, NBC News during the Vietnam War, for instance. You know, like, I think that kind of media literacy could have been useful at other points in our, like, so I guess how much do you think this is, like, a new problem versus just sort of an old problem through the frame of a new technology?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, I definitely feel like there are a lot more, you know, it's like the old monolithic news, you know, had its problems too, because it was easy to game because it was so monolithic. And I don't know, now you've got new problems where there are a lot more actors involved and a lot of bad actors, and there's just a crazy, crazy landscape, you know. I don't have anything great to say about that.
And it just, you know, and it just seems like such an uphill battle to try to teach people one at a time. I mean, maybe there's just no other way to do it, but it just seems like a very inefficient process to just be kind of trying on a case by case basis. Yeah, saying to people like, "Hey, this particular account you're looking at is fake."
Yeah, because I mean, they also, you know, I have no doubt they're just going on to the next one and believing that, you know, for a lot of them. So it's kind of like I don't know.
I ideally you get sort of like an each one teach one kind of result where, like, not only do you convince someone that this particular account is fake, but you're like, hey, this thing seems to be this fake news thing seems to be a problem in this Facebook group that you're frequenting. You know, maybe you should think about pointing it out to some other people when you sort of like recruit them into the cause. I mean, maybe that's too ambitious. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe you could encourage people like, hey, share this article with your, you know, with your friends, because look at all these people impersonating Americans. You know, it's a real problem. Yeah, and like I also have, you know, found it kind of valuable from a persuasion technique to say, like, this isn't just a, you know, a liberal conservative thing. Like, I can, you know, I can show you, you know, anti-Trump fake accounts too. So that encourages them to be like, oh, maybe I'll share this because it's not just a, you know, a political thing, you know.
Do you think there's a trend to it? I mean, do you think there's more of it happening on the one side or the other? Or do you think it really is kind of an equal opportunity problem?
Oh, no, it's much more conservative stuff, fake accounts. I mean, that's, yeah, it's much higher. Like, the ratio is huge, you know, and, maybe, you know, who's to say it wouldn't be the opposite if Hillary was president? I don't know. Right. Maybe it'd be a bunch of, you know. But I think it definitely seems to be, like, you know, hate to say it, but there's been interviews with fake news creators who say, you know, we did try to make liberal fake news, but it never caught on. Like, they just wouldn't get the clicks, you know. And you know, there's been several people that have said that, from like Macedonians to like an American fake news guy who, you know, was, you know, they found this guy who was responsible for a bunch of fake news, you know, before the election, and he, you know, is now public about it because he was outed. So now he's like kind of trying to embrace it. And he had a quote to that effect too, where he's like, you know, it just, the conservative stuff just got a lot more clicks. Like, there was a lot more, basically a lot more hatred going on there.
Yeah, and that's kind of what I worry about, is this is just kind of a problem of not being able to keep up with technology, like our media literacy not being able to keep up with the rate to which bad actors can, like, exploit our media illiteracy, or just like with constant new technologies having to learn new strategies all the time. It seems like the pace of the technological change is going to continue a lot faster than the pace of I guess human media literacy. And I mean, and also I guess, well, yeah, let me leave it there first. Is there anything you want to say to that?
Well, yeah, like the new technology that they already are coming out with, where you can like put somebody's face on a video and replace the replace the face in the video with somebody else's face, you know.
Right.
That's like a pretty advanced technology already. So like just thinking about the fake news that's going to create is crazy and scary.
And that way, I mean, that's something I've kind of like vaguely heard of or aware of, and I can only imagine how many other people like don't. And I think I'm probably above average for an American in terms of awareness of something like that. So I can only imagine how many other people would, you know, be skeptical of someone telling them that that was even a thing. Like if they saw a video and someone was like, "Oh, that's been, you know, changed, superimposed. They superimposed me, man."
Yeah. What is that from Superimposed?
It was an Adam Sandler bit.
Oh yeah.
About like a goat that like was supposed to stay home during the day. I don't remember the premise of it entirely, but I remember they superimposed me, man. Was like
superimposed me, man. Yeah, that's gonna be that's some scary stuff, because I can totally see that, like, you know, getting out into the wild and creating some really confusing situations.
But then the other place where I started to go from this, and then I realized, well, you know, even like Americans are probably, I mean, I would think certainly in like the top decile of the world in terms of being able to cope with that, or like having a fair number of citizens anyway who can distinguish. I mean, how much do you have a sense of how large the problem is outside of the United States in terms of people being manipulated by fake accounts?
You hear about there are some articles about that this happening in Europe and and around the Baltic states and stuff. I don't really have a good sense of it. I haven't read a lot about it, so I know they do say it. It has been happening, yeah. And also the Cambridge Analytica, Africa thing. I don't know if you heard about that, but there was something where they were, they had some campaign they were doing. I can't remember which country in Africa, but they were doing some campaign for someone. They had been paid to create propaganda in Africa, in an African country.
Yeah, I don't think I did hear about that.
What was I going to say? Oh. I will say, before we get too far, if anybody, I'm still doing some research on, there's an American producer of fake news. I won't say the brand/site, but it's, if anybody has any legal experience about anonymous corporations and how you might legally out them, or else just the legality around like exposing the identities of anonymous corporations that are like anonymous, legal entities. If anybody has any experience on that, contact me, because I just want to give that shout out. That's the one thing I'm doing some work on now that I haven't had gotten much luck on getting advice for. So I just want to give that shout out.
Sure. Is there anything else you wanted to say on this subject?
Oh, not really. I mean, it's more of just something I don't have a whole lot of experience or knowledge about it. It's more just something I've done a little bit in the free time here and there, and I think it's I think it's great that it got more attention, because that was my whole goal, and trying to be like, why aren't people talking about this more? So I think it's just good that people, like, whenever they encounter stuff online, should just be like, maybe this person isn't real.
Yeah, I mean, part of me is sort of like, I mean, I'm certainly glad that you're doing it and you're available as a resource. At the same time, I think you kind of implied this also, it's kind of disturbing that there's not a better person for like the New York Times and the Washington Post to go to than you.
I know, exactly. No, I agree. Like that was the only thing I told them when I was like, really, I think the most noteworthy thing is like that I'm just really nobody special, and like it's really just a reflection on how bad Facebook has failed, and that was the main reflection, I think, was like, it's not, just Facebook should be making people jump through more hoops if like their account is flagged as suspicious, and I feel like that's low hanging fruit. It's like some things could alert them that this might be a fake account, and then they just make somebody jump through some more hoops to prove their identity, because Facebook claims that they're, it's against their terms of services to have a fake account, but they don't seem to do much to prevent it,
Yeah.
So,
I mean, I guess the one thing I am also inclined to think is, I don't know if it's fair to say lazy, but journalists are under a lot of time pressure or whatever else, and just know, I mean, I would hope that they would write about an issue like this somewhat differently than they would write about, say, poker. But I know that, you know, when they are doing articles on poker, they're not necessarily seeking out the very best source they can find. No. It's more, do I know someone who is a poker player, or do I know someone who knows someone who's a poker player? Okay, that'll be my source. Like, it's not...
Exactly, yeah, exactly. It's kind of like, it does make you wonder, you know, how much due diligence and knowledge is put into a lot of articles, you know, and kind of, which is like, goes back to the, you know, be skeptical of everything, you know. It's like, a lot of these, you know, it's like having firsthand knowledge of how they wrote these articles, I'm kind of like, I can see the flaws in the approach, and I'm kind of like, you know, that could have been done better, and here's some better questions they could have asked, and, you know, it's you know, everybody's fallible at the end of the day, you know. It's like, nobody's perfect, and no, there's no, like, one source of great, you know, fantastic information.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know where to think that an issue like this would sit. I mean, I do think it's a little problematic, because I've seen poker players make this argument before, where they sort of say, like, think about how bad the media, what a bad job they do covering poker. Like, they must do an equally bad job covering, like, the Israel-Palestine conflict. Though I think they are putting somewhat more effort into, I don't think that's too idealistic of me to think that, like, there are people who are, you know, like, they have, or at least, you know, some of the more prominent media outlets, like, have an office in Jerusalem, in a way.
Right,
like, and they have specialists in the region.
I think it gets a lot more review, too, right? As opposed to, like, a poker article might get, like, just the writer reviewing it, or one proofreader, whereas, like, something about the Mideast conflict is going to get multiple eyes on it, you know?
Right.
Like, for sure.
Yeah, but I don't know where an issue like this would fall. What section of the paper did it end up in? Do you know? For the New York Times article that you were quoted in, do you know what section of the paper it was in?
No, I don't know.
Once again, our strategy sponsor is good old Tournament Poker Edge. Wide variety of tournament poker strategy for a wide variety of tournament formats available to you on Tournament Poker Edge. I even have some hand history reviews on there where I'm talking about hands that I played in live poker tournaments, and I talk in some cases about how tells and other material from Zach Elwood's books played into my decisions. So, even if you're interested in stuff related to making use of tells in live poker tournaments, even that you can find at tournamentpokeredge.com.
As I mentioned, I have now finished reading, but at the time that I played this hand, I was in the process of reading or rereading Exploiting Poker Tells, and I was kind of trying to be extra diligent for some of these things, and I got into a hand where there was definitely some behavioral process on my opponent, combined with a sort of strange betting line, and I'm curious to get your take on how to interpret this. So we're at the 200-400 level with the 50 ante. A player in early position raises to...
And one second, what event, or how big was this event again?
This was a 1650 or 1675, I think it was 1675, but yeah, it was a WSOP circuit main event, so relatively significant. I think certainly for the other player who is not a professional player, I think this was one of the bigger tournaments that person is likely to play this year.
Gotcha, yeah.
So this person opens to 1100, gets called by the button, so it's an early position raise, and the button calls. And the flop is Jack 4-3 rainbow. The early position bets 1300. The button says raise and makes it 4000. So just right there, what do you make when players vocalize raise? What are your thoughts on that?
I don't have a lot of thought about it. I said in the in verbal poker tells, I think it's like slightly correlated to strength. I think it varies a lot though. Like, so in a vacuum, I wouldn't have a lot of feeling about it.
And that would be sort of because it's kind of like calling attention to yourself, which bluffers tend not to like to do.
Yeah, I think vocalization with bets in general will be, you know, skewed towards strength a little bit, but I also feel like it varies a lot because you can also have people wanting to seem confident.
Right,
you know,
that was my thought, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think, I think it varies a lot. Like, some people will vocalize more when they're weak. So I think it's, to a larger extent, it's like a player-specific kind of thing.
And then the early position player who initially bet the 1,300 and then button raises to 4,000, the early position player calls very quickly. And typically, mm-hmm. I think that, you know, and this is not original to you, although you mentioned it in your book, but I think this is one of the tells that people have been aware of for a while, is that, you know, a quick call indicates the person didn't have a lot to think about.
Right, they probably had, what was the flop again?
Jack 4-3 rainbow.
Yeah, like, it's probably like, you know, I could see it being, you know, queens easily, because that's like something they know they're going to call and not re-raise with, whereas, like, I would think stronger than that, like, they would have to think about what their strategy is, you know, or maybe, you know, maybe it's ace jack suited or something. Yeah, it's like, it's around there, I would feel like. Yeah,
One of the things that you emphasize that I like is the importance of analyzing this stuff in context. And so with a board of this texture, I would think there's a chance that people might be a little more comfortable just like knowing immediately that they're going to slow play if they have, say, pocket jacks or any set that they like. If the board were like jack 7-5 two tone, I would think there'd be an even stronger argument to say, well, a snap call is not a set. Like, people would definitely want to think about re-raising.
Exactly. Yeah. So the dryness of the board increases the likelihood they would snap call with a super strong hand. Yeah.
Yeah. Although I was still kind of inclined to think the snap call was I mean, and just super strong hands are unlikely as a background probability.
Right. In general, it'll generally still be the medium strength, but like, yeah, you're exactly right. Yeah, it does throw into the mix the possibility that they would snap call with a set. Yeah.
Now the turn is a second jack, so the board now is jack 4-3 jack. I believe it was still a rainbow. I don't remember, but I don't think it was super important whether to put a flush draw up there. Uh-huh. The early position player checks, and the button, and this is where I think Twitter let us down a little bit, because I wasn't able to fully describe the button's behavior here. I interpreted the button's behavior to be ostentatious, which for Carlos Welch means it was showy. You know, he was acting. Uh-huh. If we go back to the Mike Caro, you know, distinguish between tells from actors and tells from non-actors, this felt to me like a tell from an actor. So he picked up chips as though he were going to bet, or as though he's like thinking about betting, and he holds the chips for a second, and then he puts them back down and checks.
Oh, okay.
So that's, I would say, the most gratuitous.
Right. So it's kind of like he was over the top acting, not like just a slight act. It was kind of like,
yeah,
he really, really seeming to like want to communicate, like, I'm really uncertain here.
Right.
Like,
I took it to be a
yeah, that's what you're saying. Yeah. Right, it's like a little too over the top, and you're like, well, yeah, would he? Yeah, I see what you're saying. Like, increases the likelihood he might be acting with a strong hand.
So I was actually thinking the opposite. I guess I was thinking of that as sort of a defensive, like, oh, you better be careful betting into me because, you know, I had a hand I could have almost bet, so better be careful betting into me on the river.
Yeah, that's my general interpretation of those things in general. I thought you were saying the opposite. But yeah, that's my general interpretation of the ostentatious kind of any kind of thing like that when somebody checks is like, I think it's going to be defensive. Yeah.
Yeah, so that was, yeah, I was thinking of like the waiting for action tells, I guess, is what you call them. Or I guess the action was on him in this case, but he's trying to he's trying to preempt river action was my interpretation.
Yeah, I call it in the book I call it like ostentatious from a ostentatious behavior from a non-aggressor. Like when somebody checks or calls and has ostentatious behavior, it makes it less likely they're strong. Mm. Yeah.
And then the river brings an ace. So the board now is jack 4-3 jack ace. The original raiser in early position checks again, and the button now very quickly and confidently bets 6,500 into a pot that's probably 11,000 or 12,000 at this point, so it's, you know, a little over half pot. And, you know, again, there wasn't really a lot of I wouldn't say it was necessarily like ostentatiously quick, but it wasn't like he had a decision on whether or not he was going to bet. Like, it was, mm-hmm. he bet pretty quickly when the action was on him.
Mm-hmm.
which I found to be a weird combination with the turn check. I was interpreting, especially with the showiness of the turn check, I was interpreting as a, hey, I've got sort of a medium strength kind of hand. I'm trying to get it to showdown. I really don't want to face
I've got
a bet.
Something.
Right.
Yeah, I've got something I can call with.
I don't want to face a bet on the river. Like that. Yeah, that's how I interpreted the turn. So, but then I would expect that that player not wanting to face a bet on the river would also not want to make a bet on the river. Even though in theory there should exist a set of hands that like isn't going to be happy getting bet into, but will be happy getting checked to. I think for a lot of recreational players, that's not really a set of hands that exists. Like they either want to put money in the pot or they don't, and they're not distinguishing. Like they just, there's a lot of people who don't make thin value bets, especially not for relatively large. Like this was a tournament where we started, I think, with 20K, and this is like a third of a starting stack that he's betting on the river. It doesn't strike me as the sort of thing that a lot of people would do, especially on a river ace, where you know if he has like pocket kings and he doesn't want to get bet into on the turn, but then the river, now like, is he value betting kings on an ace river? You know, that didn't seem too likely to me.
Right. Yeah, and you thought he wasn't, I mean, it's not like he had shown many signs of being aggressive previously, right?
I don't know that I had information on that one way or the other. I guess it was more just, I wouldn't think, so if he had a draw, like let's say he had 6-5, so he's got an open-ended straight draw on the turn. If he were out of position and he did the ostentatious, you know, chip grab, contemplate a bet, decide to check, that would make sense to me, because then he'd be saying, I don't want you to bet the turn, I'm trying to deter you from betting the turn so I can get a free card on the river. Mm-hmm. But given that he's in position on the turn, the 6-5, I mean, either he hits and he's happy to face a bet on the river, or he misses and he doesn't really care if he faces a bet on the river. So I don't think he has that same incentive holding 6-5 to try to deter a river bet.
Right, and to immediately bet on the river too is a pretty interesting thing too. Like I see what you're saying there, because like for recreational players, most people aren't, you know, capable of like a large immediate, you know, bluff like that. Like it's not that common for your average, you know.
Yeah, they sort of have to summon up the courage to bluff, especially since there wasn't a long tank on the turn. Like maybe on the turn he's already planning that he's going to bluff the river, but there wasn't really that kind of time to make that.
Yeah. So, did you want to talk about what you? Because you had a guess of what it was.
Right. So I felt like there was this pretty strong disparity between the turn action and the river action, and essentially it seemed to me he must have improved. Not only improved his hand, but improved his hand in a way that moved it from the marginal hand category. Right, so I tend to think of hands in these three categories, and people who are familiar with my stuff on like Turn and Poker Edge will recognize these categories. But that he goes from having a marginal hand where his primary goal is that he wants to get it to showdown cheaply. That's how I interpret the turn action, is that he's trying to buy himself a cheap showdown. Mm-hmm. And so that's inconsistent then with the river bet. The river bet would be more consistent with having a polarized range. And given that you can't really, or like this isn't a river anyway, but I would really think of as turning a marginal hand into a weak hand that would want to bluff. Like maybe there are some rivers that just, but again, that's not really a thing recreational players do that well, is recognize when a hand that had showdown value no longer does and turn it into a bluff. There's not a lot of spots where people tend to do that. I think it's easier for a hand to go the opposite direction, to go from being a marginal hand to being suddenly a hand where the player's like, oh wow, now I have a really good hand. So how could an ace, you know, change his perspective on that? The three hands that would come to mind are 5-deuce if he had open-ended on the turn, but I've already talked about in the context of 6-5 why I didn't think an open-ended draw made sense on the turn. So 5-deuce I would feel the same way about, that he wouldn't bother doing the ostentatious check on the turn if he had 5-deuce. Ace-jack could be improved by an ace on the river, but again, ace-jack was already a very strong hand on the turn. I wouldn't expect the ostentatious, you know, grab your chips. And so pocket aces, despite the fact that he didn't re-raise before the flop, I had trouble finding a better candidate for him than pocket aces, where on the turn, he's not happy to see the jack pair on the turn. Suddenly he's worried. He's like, uh-oh, I really don't want to face a bet on the river now that a second jack has come. I'm going to try to deter a river bet. And then when the ace comes on the river, of course, he changes his mind about how he feels about his pocket aces. That was the hand that I thought made the most sense, despite the lack of a 3-bet pre-flop.
And how confident were you before you turned his hand over?
I mean, I didn't have a lot of time to assess that. I was just sort of like, as I watched the hand, I was like, whoa, that was a weird that was a weird river bet. And the opponent tanked for maybe 20 seconds before he folded, so I had a little bit of time to think about it, which is when I did that. But I didn't really have a chance to assess, like, how much would I be willing, or what kind of odds would I lay that this guy has pocket aces? Right. And, you know, once I knew the results, I don't think I can fairly look back on it and say. But that was sort of I was like, whoa, that's weird. What hand would make sense there? It's really only
aces. A weird combination of, things. Yeah, I wonder, do you think there was a kind of a, maybe you had a subconscious or conscious sense of, like, this was a guy, just based on what you'd seen in the short period, this was a guy that would be unlikely to bet the river that big, that quick, without a super strong hand? Do you think that played into it a little bit?
I don't know how specific it was to this. Like, I think most people don't do that. I think, in general, people are pretty bad at making thin value bets. And to some degree, and when we're talking about a large bet in a tournament, it's kind of correct not to make a lot of thin value bets. I guess we could think maybe, like, I guess Ace-King is a hand that I didn't mention here, where, you know, maybe he peels the, like, I guess it's not really that implausible that he could have Ace-King, that he, maybe if he's playing Ace, it's pretty flop.
That too, like, he was just making a weird, you know, a weird raise on the flop, like some people do sometimes, and, you know, yeah, but then again, yeah, would he really bet that big and that quick on the river? That's unlikely.
Yeah, and I think he wouldn't be thinking about Ace-King as a hand that was likely to be good once his flop raise is called. Like, I don't think he's raising Ace-King on the flop, getting called, and then still thinking, like, hey, maybe I can take this to showdown and win. So, like, even if there's a chance he's right, but I still don't think that's the thought process I would expect him. I would expect anyone other than, like, a very sophisticated player to have that thought. And I think a lot of people just aren't going to bet Ace-King even on the river. Like, they're going to see that paired jack, and they're going to be afraid of getting check-raised on the river, and they're just going to check it back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, with your description, like, it makes more sense. I mean, honestly, I've played very few tournaments. I'm just used to cash games. So, like, I feel like, yeah, you've got a better sense of the dynamic. You know, you know the dynamic of these, like, pretty high buy-in tournaments.
Honestly,
like,
I want to say this is not specific to tournaments. I mean, maybe it's specific to higher stakes cash game, or recreational players playing in higher stakes cash games as well. But I mean, I would think the same thing in a cash game.
It's just where somebody's taking it seriously, which is not always the case in a lot of cash games, where you see a lot more quirky stuff and
it's got to be a case where, like, he cares a lot about getting his hand to showdown if it's good, and is going to be, like, if anything, except, like, I guess the fact that that the stakes are, if anything, a little intimidating to him is going to play into the fear of facing a bet or facing a raise on the river when he has aces.
I think there's a lot of help knowing that someone's taking it seriously, and then you haven't seen them, you know, do something quirky and weird and random previously in the game, which a lot of times you'll see somebody do something random and you're like, well, now that throws off my reads for, you know, a long time, because now I can't understand what they did in that one hand, you know?
Yeah, and I think that's one gap between us. I think I'm pretty rarely playing with people who aren't taking it seriously in the way that you mean. So I probably don't have as many opportunities to observe some of
what you've got in mind. Random.
Yeah.
You're playing with the more serious class of players. Like, most of my experience the last few years was like 5-10 and 2-5 cash games with a lot of players who didn't know what they were doing. So that's like a lot of my recent experience. I think there's definitely, you can definitely get some much more defined reads when you're playing with people who, like, you know, are taking it pretty seriously and you haven't seen do something weird and quirky.
As you were saying, in the context of, like, the main event, on the one hand, people do tend to give away less because they're more aware of not wanting to give things away, but it also means that when there is a behavior, it's a lot more likely to be meaningful, like, because people are being careful about their behaviors. I think you're less likely to see someone just sort of, like, thoughtlessly grab chips and then change his mind and be like, oh no, actually I don't want to bet, I'm just going to check it back. I think people are stoic enough that doesn't happen as much, and so when they do grab chips, there's probably a reason to it, and it's not the just level one, like, oh, he just actually changed his mind.
Right. Yeah, and speaking, like, kind of tied into this hand, a lot of the, like, when you're talking about the main event kind of tells, a lot of that stuff will be, you know, signs, indicators of strength. It'll be, like, spots where they've, like, you know, just let their guard down and are showing, like, signs of being genuinely relaxed. Like, a lot of the most confident reads I've had, like, the main event, you know, final table, have been where somebody just let themselves get really loose and, you know, did something that they would be very unlikely to do if they were, you know, bluffing. Mm-hmm. sort of like this guy, you know, betting quickly on the river, like, that helps us, you know, polarize his hand strength, and it's like, you know, how many bluffs or borderline, you know, turning his hand into a bluff, you know, how many of those things exist versus super strong hands, you know?
Yeah. Do you have time for me to tell you one other quick story?
Oh, sure.
So this is, I have these cousin, or my cousin has three sons who are, the one's about to turn 12, and then the other two are 8 and 5. And I've been playing poker for a couple of years with the ones who are now 12 and 8, but I was out there a couple of days ago, and it was the first time that the youngest one, the 5-year-old, played with us also. And I always find it, I mean, in some ways it's boring because, of course, they're, you know, not good poker players. But it's interesting for me to, among other things, just to see how many behaviors that I see among, like, serious adult poker players, I also see with, you know, these kids just, like, getting frustrated about bad beats or not getting dealt good hands, or, like, we played a round of Omaha, and I had a flush and beat the 8-year-old straight, and he was like, I thought a straight was a really good hand. I was like, yes, that's why this game was invented, because people think straights are good hands, and then you take advantage of that. Like, I was explaining that kind of stuff, because they really like tricks and deceit. Like, they're really interested in that kind of stuff. So, you know, explaining, like, oh, this is how the game was invented, in order to trick people into making that mistake that you just made. Like, they find that kind of stuff interesting.
You should be live streaming this on Twitch. It'd be a great, it's like it's like a study of, the beginner level of poker, you know. It's
I think their parents wouldn't be too wild about them having that level of exposure on the internet, but I'll send you, I do have a short clip of one of them narrating to me over Skype a time when he was playing poker that I did get permission to post.
I was just kidding about the live stream, but it'd be funny, like, get a hand histories from kids.
That's essentially what this is. He's telling me about, he made a royal straight flush, and
that's pretty fun.
So we're playing, this particular hand is, we're playing 5-card draw, and the 12-year-old, he looks at his cards, and then he does, a really blatant, like, kind of, like, clucks his tongue and shakes his head in a high check, and I was like, oh, nice, he's got a strong hand. And nice. I think
the Caro traditional tell.
Yeah, like, especially the 5-year-old, like, he didn't even know what he had, so, like, his behavior was not going to be telling. But so the 12-year-old, like, certainly knew enough about poker to recognize when he had a strong hand, and to have an idea of, like, that he's trying to manipulate people, but not to have the sophistication to go beyond, like, level one manipulation. It was just, like, a really clear textbook example of that. So
that's interesting. Yeah, poker clap.
The poker clap was in there, exactly. So, you know, I of course checked, because I know he's got a strong hand. And then the 5-year-old, who he's taken him just sort of making very large, including sometimes all in bets, just because he's probably bored or whatever, or just because it was working and he's not thinking about odds. He's just thinking, like, hey, I'm winning pots by doing this, which I was kind of interested in letting that play out. It was really upsetting the 8-year-old, but I wanted them to see why it wasn't a good strategy.
What would happen?
I wanted to be like, well, he's allowed to bet whatever he wants, right? We're playing no limit. He can, if he wants to bet $1 into a pot with 4 cents in it, he's allowed to do that. And, you know, so this particular hand, he goes all in, like $1 into 4 cents, and folds back around to the 12-year-old, who, of course, very happily calls. And the 5-year-old actually has trip deuces, and he actually did pick up a really good hand. And the 12-year-old just had pocket aces and lost. And I had to laugh. It was so funny that he actually picked up. And I don't know to what extent he, like, realized that he had trip twos, versus was just, like, just happened to have it at a time when he was already randomly going all in, but it just, like, he had the image to do it, and then he did it, and it worked out for him. But then the 12-year-old left the game in tears, so my laughing probably wasn't actually helpful. It was just too good.
Nice. That's some classic stuff.
Anything else you wanted to talk about that we didn't get around to?
No, I think that's, yeah, we discussed a lot. Hopefully it's interesting to your audience with all the fake account stuff.
Yeah, we put an hour into Syrian refugees on last week's show, so
some
people will are interested in the non-poker stuff, and I imagine some people are not going to appreciate this back-to-back.
Well, you could tell them to, make sure you tell them to skip to the end when we talk about poker.
Yeah, I will mention that this is in here. Some kind of pill.
or the devotion of a Carmelite, or the fair passage of a bill, and who will sign us into law? I know you